Welcome to The Investing Show, where we discuss the news that matters to investors and get ideas to help you make more of your money. I'm Simon Lambert, this is Money. Joining me on the show today, I have Hugo Ewer, co-manager of the Troy Income and Growth Trust. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And Richard Hunter of Interactive Investor.
Hi, Simon.
Hugo, Troy Income and Growth Trust. Now, that implies to me that it's not just all about the dividends. Where does the balance fit between those two things in terms of the companies that you're investing in and the eventual sort of outcome of what you hope to get?
You're absolutely right, Simon, and the name says it all, really. What we're trying to deliver is a balance between income and capital growth. And for that reason, and it's not just about high yield, it's about owning companies with dividends that we think can steadily grow into the future. And because those cash flows and those streams of income are growing, we think that that implies that the capital value of those investments will grow as well. And so we expect to produce a portfolio return that has a balance between those two aspects, a yield that is probably a little bit below the market, 3.2% today versus 4% for the market, but a healthy contribution from capital growth as well.
And that presumably feeds through to being able to hopefully either maintain that dividend or perhaps increase it in years to come, but also to see the share price of the trust increase as well, rather than it just being all about paying investors the dividend.
Absolutely. And we've grown the trust dividend about 5% on average over the last 5 years, so ahead of inflation, so investors are getting a real increase in their dividend. But the trust's total return has been nearer 8-9% on average over the long term since we've been running it. So you can see that, you know, if you've got a 3.5% dividend yield or thereabouts, a substantial portion of that return is coming from capital, and that's very important. And that's reflected in the stocks that we own and the way we invest and the sorts of companies we look for.
And what does a typical company that you invest in look like then? Is it that you look very much stock specific and evaluate each one on its merit, but there are some boxes that they all tick?
They're not necessarily boxes that they all tick. There are some common characteristics, I think. We start by trying to find quality companies, and that can mean very different things to different people. But to us, it means companies that we can be really confident that they will be around and more valuable in 10 years' time. And that sort of long-term nature of our investment process is very important. We're looking for companies that have something special about the product that they deliver, which means they're less likely to be disintermediated, less likely to see regulatory change affect their product. So either very strong intellectual property, so patents in the pharmaceuticals industry, strong brands. We own Unilever, and so brands like Dove and Knorr are you know, strong household brands that most of your viewers will know, and are repeat purchases. Alternatively, companies that operate in specific niches, so Sabre Insurance insures non-standard drivers who either have higher risk vehicles, more valuable vehicles, or less reassuring driving histories, let's say, or young drivers. And they operate in that particular niche. So we're looking for something unique about these companies that allows them gives us confidence that they can continue to produce their product and sell their product with a sizable margin. We're looking for companies that are well-financed, and we're talking here about the use of leverage. We're not anti-debt on balance sheets per se, but we want a level of confidence that that debt is proportionate to the sort of business. So highly cyclical businesses, we'd much rather see less debt. Obviously, utility-like companies, we'd be prepared to take a little bit more debt. Management are very important in our process. We want management teams who are well-aligned with us as shareholders. We want management teams who have a long-term strategy and act like owners of the business rather than just hired guns looking to see out their tenure and maximise their returns over that period.
Obviously, there's been a lot written about dividends at the moment in the historically low interest rate in which we find ourselves. And some of the things that are coming out of that is a sort of predilection for some investors just to be chasing a dividend yield. But that's quite a dangerous thing to be doing, particularly where we are at the moment, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think this is something that we've noticed the shape of the market dividend change quite materially over the last 3 years, 4 years, perhaps. What we see is companies have moved into two different groups, and where companies are able to continue to deliver growth, they're being rewarded for that growth, and the yields have been compressed a little bit. So companies that perhaps yielded 4% a few years ago are now yielding 3.5%, 3%. And those are companies that can continue to grow, and the market is continuing to like those companies. At the other end of the spectrum, we're seeing companies where I think the market has much more doubts over the long-term growth. And these companies have seen less strong share price performances. And as the shares have fallen or moved sideways, those yields have expanded, and you're seeing yields of 5, 6%. But our concern about those companies, and not all of them, but as a cohort, our concern would be that, you know, these are companies that are going to struggle to grow their dividends. And you can see in many cases, the dividend cover is very low. So the ability of the company to generate excess cash to reinvest and continue to grow the company is limited. And although they are attractive to generate income over the short term, as long-term investors, we worry that they're not going to drive the capital growth of the portfolio in the same way.
Sure. And when you look at some of those companies that are the high-yielding companies versus the ones that can produce the growth, how do you cut the balance between the two when you're thinking, should we invest in this company? I mean, presumably, with some of those, there is a value opportunity there, but with others, they are a value trap.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there are always companies that have stock-specific reasons for being cheap, and whether they be management-related or change in regulation, for example, that have short-term impacts on those stocks, where you do see yields, you know, above 4%, and we think in the long term they are attractive. But where, you know, when you look at a company like Royal Mail, who is still a regulated business but is facing very, very steep competition from a wide set of non-regulated peers, you know, you have to ask yourself, how does this company compete with a unionised workforce against the unencumbered competitive set? And, you know, we were investors in Royal Mail, we're not anymore. That's a sense of the sort of challenge that these companies are facing.
It's quite a difficult time as well, isn't it? Because I think it's largely accepted that for some institutional investors, they pretty much weren't going to touch the UK with the barge pole over the last couple of years for obvious reasons. And yet, if you look at last year, for example, the FTSE 100 returned over 12% in capital growth. Obviously, you've got the 4-ish percent dividend yield on top. Is it getting, particularly at the quality end, if you like, is it getting more difficult with that in mind to pick out some real value companies?
I think there is, after 10 years of broadly upward and rising markets, yes, there is a challenge to find value opportunities. Obviously, the cyclical overlay on top of that in terms of, you know, the positive nature of people's views or less positive nature of people's views around the UK market has an impact. And clearly, there's been a more UK domestic part of the economy, which has seen more value. And, you know, we have had limited investments in that, which allowed us to participate very handsomely in the performance last year. Less so in the final quarter, but because we did have some exposure to that, and stocks like Lloyds and Land Securities we own in the portfolio, and they benefited from that post-election bounce. But I think, broadly speaking, you know, we would be less focused on those sort of areas of the market, and it's really about creating a portfolio where we think there are long-term compounding returns that we can generate, rather than trying to second-guess the outcome of the next binary event in markets.
Sure. With the companies that you invest in, how many different companies do you hold in the trust?
We hold about 40, 45 different companies in the trust,
so
typically.
Among those companies, are they largely focused on bigger companies, or do you look to sort of mid-caps and smaller companies as well?
Coincidentally, we have a weighting split that is roughly the same as the all-share. That's not something that we think of particularly or construct the portfolio to reflect. In fact, the opposite is almost true, in that we pay very little attention generally to sector weightings and stock weightings in the index. We do have this bias towards quality, which means that it's not surprising that larger, better established companies with stronger corporate governance and track records, longer longer lifespans of their products tend to be in focus in the portfolio, and that's on a long-term view as well as over short periods. There would be situations, though, where I think, you know, there would be a really exciting opportunity to get more involved and own more in the FTSE 250. Where we see the quality in the FTSE 250 is around a lot of the fantastic engineering companies, the Spirax Sarcos, Rotorx of this world. But those companies are expensive today, and we've been cautious about investing there. If we were to see a little bit of a pause in the market or a little bit of a derating, then absolutely, I think that FTSE 250 weighting may go up a little bit.
And are there any areas of the market or companies specifically that you see the opportunity for dividend and dividend growth coming through at the moment that you're building a position in, for example?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, typically we're looking for companies where there's already a fairly well-established pattern of dividend growth. There are companies like Victrex, which I think, you know, has a unique product, has a fantastic set of growth opportunities for that product. Victrex manufacture a very high-performing polymer, which is used in lightweighting aircraft, lightweighting electric vehicles. It's also used in implants in the body, so dental implants and knee and spinal implants as well. And that opportunity set for this company to grow and grow the dividend along with that is you know, the sort of thing that we're looking for. There are companies, I think, where, you know, you see a focus on cash flow, and, you know, we do own, although significantly less than the market, we do own some oils and some of the oil majors in the portfolio. And there, that concentration on cash flow generation has meant that the prospects for dividend growth are better there today than they have been in the past.
Presumably because they had such a torrid time of it in recent years, they had to really cut everything back to the bone, and so they've got themselves into a much better financial position. And is that true of various bits of the market, perhaps? Do you think companies now are a little bit more wary sometimes around their financial position, about maybe that cash flow, the keeping debt low, the paying a small dividend and growing it, than they would have perhaps been a decade ago?
I think that was certainly true at the beginning of the sort of post-global financial crisis period. But where you've seen the cost of debt persistently very, very low, companies have used debt to buy back their own shares. It's been particularly prevalent in the US, which is obviously not our central sort of hunting ground for stocks. But there, a certain amount of that has carried across the UK markets. And I think, you know, where acquisitions have been cheap, if they're funded by debt, companies have allowed debt to drift up a little bit. So, yes, there are companies that are still have the same management teams in place who learned valuable lessons through the global financial crisis, but there's also a good sizable cohort of companies out there who I wouldn't say have learned that lesson quite as well.
There are plenty of people in charge of companies with short memories and a desire for large wage packets.
Yes.
Yeah, indeed. In terms of your investors, people buying into the trust, one of the great things about an income investment trust is the ability to hold back some of the money in the good years to help pay the dividends in the bad years. And that's one of the things that has led to so many investment trusts having such a, you know, spectacularly good dividend history. But people worry about another element, which is the discount and potentially also the premium for the share price to the NAV. You have a discount control mechanism, don't you? And was that brought in relatively recently, and how does it work?
So you're absolutely right. The trusts have a revenue reserve, and our revenue reserve is about 50% of a full year's dividend. So if we were to pay uncovered dividends from earnings, we could top that up. And you're absolutely right that dividend growth profile is important to our investors something that the board are keen to maintain as well. The discount control mechanism is something that's been in place since we took over the trust shortly after we took over the trust in 2009. So we had a AGM in 2010 and put the discount control mechanism in place then. And really what we felt was that there is a role for permanent capital vehicles where you have a liquid underlying asset, so in property or private equity, for example. That sense of having permanent capital makes a lot, is easy to justify. Where you have liquid underlying assets, which shares in essentially and especially with a reasonable weighting to the FTSE 100 are, we felt there was no reason why our shareholders shouldn't be able to sell shares or buy shares at a price that was very close to net asset value. We actually feel that in liquid, with liquid underlying assets, a discount or a premium is a transfer of risk from the investment manager to the shareholder, which I don't think is justified. So the trust stands behind the market and the brokers, and on a daily basis will buy back or issue shares to meet excess supply or demand of the trust shares. And as a result, the trust trades within 1 or 2 percentage points of its NAV and has done ever since that discount control mechanism was put in place.
One of the things, of course, we're starting to hear more and more about, and the noise will obviously get louder, is the sort of ESG concerns, environmental, social, corporate governance, as you know. Is that something that is one of the boxes you find yourself increasingly having to tick, or is it not, for the moment, a major concern?
So I wear two hats at Troy. I'm co-manager of the trust. I'm also our head of responsible investment. And so I'm very happy to talk about this for the rest of the programme if you want. But I think it's very, very important. And it is especially important if you are long-term investors. If you're looking at the risk and return that a company can generate and you're planning on holding those shares for 10 years, you need to be aware of the risks that you're facing as an investor and the opportunity set that you're buying into. And a considerable portion of that risk and opportunity set relates to environmental, social and governance factors. And so we've always felt it's important to understand these things. We're using the nomenclature that the market is using more today than we were 10 years ago, but we've always looked first at the risks and looked at the upside secondly, and always wanted to be very confident that that process of compounding is not going to get disrupted over the course of our investment time horizon. So these things are important, and when you look at a stock like Sabre, which I mentioned earlier, you know, they don't make returns from monthly instalments on insurance policies because those are levied on people who can't afford to pay their entire insurance policy up front. And we think there's a regulatory risk around something like that. The regulator hasn't addressed it as yet, but some of the motor insurance sector make a very large portion of their profits out of those instalment payments and other ancillary revenues. And so those sorts of things are integral to our process and understanding social risks like that.
Yes, I was having a conversation with an investor about this recently and about the sort of ESG thing and whether the E was the really important bit, the real tailwind. And he agreed, but he said, but the S and the G are really important as well, because if your governance isn't very good, well, you're just a bad business. And the S bit, well, you're just laying traps for your own business, aren't you? If you don't pay attention to the social stuff that's going on, if you're doing the kind of thing you're talking about, you're risking walking into a regulatory problem or a problem from your customers or a backlash. And the environmental stuff the element there is that we need to change the ways we're doing things, governments want to change the way we're doing things, and companies are expected to do the heavy lifting over the next 10 to 20 years.
And absolutely, and I think, you know, it is one of these things where if we feel that companies have engaged with these issues well and they've addressed them and they are looking at the way in which they impact the environment, both social and physical, in which they operate, as well as their governance carefully, you can be fairly assured that the management team are taking a detailed view on the whole, the rest of the business as well. And we think it has a very high level of importance in its own right, but it's also a good indicator of management teams who have a long-term view of the world and are keen to align themselves with shareholders, which is what we're looking for.
Hugo, that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much.
Thank
you very much.
Pleasure.
And thank you very much for watching. Join us next time on The Investing Show. Goodbye.